Thank you. My name is Howard, and I'm an alcoholic. Great God to be here. Thank you, Harland, and everybody else that had anything to do with inviting me. It's an honor. I know any of you know that if you were asked, that it would be an honor, and I am honored. And I'd like to say humble. I wish, anyway. I also want to tell you, those of you that have heard our previous speakers, I know that they were exceptionally good speakers, all of them. And I know the speakers that are scheduled for the rest of the weekend, and they are also superb speakers and great AA people. And I'm not as good a speaker as any of them. I don't give that good a talk. I don't even try anymore to give that good talk. But I give a longer talk in order to make up for the quality, we add quantity to my talk. I'm certainly not going to complain that I'm nervous, and I'm not even going to say that I'm nervous, but in the last 30 minutes, I've had to go to the bathroom 3 times, and the last time, I just stood there. I haven't used that since 1991, but it was by request. But I did it anyway. So, we're going to go by my watch. I'll run through the, you know, whenever you're speaking and you want to run through the drunken log as fast as you can, yet establish the fact that you belong here. Pretty soon, it's 5 minutes left, and Terry has already told me that when my time's out, he's leaving. I just keep watching him, and when he's left, my time's over. I was born 1,000 years ago in Los Angeles, California. But I don't ever remember living in Los Angeles when I'm a kid. The only home I can remember was in a town about 45 miles southwest of Wichita, Kansas, in a little farm community that had maybe 300-400 people in it. And it was, even when I was little, I knew we were in the Bible Belt. But then as I got older and went to Oklahoma, they think they're in the Bible Belt. And Texas thinks they're in the Bible Belt. And Nebraska, South Dakota, everybody thinks they're in the, well, not everybody. California knows it is not in the Bible Belt. And California loves that. They don't want to be in the Bible Belt. But none of us know where the Bible Belt is. I know it buckles about 45 miles southwest of Wichita in this little farm community, where when I was a kid, I saw a travel log movie. And it was about training wild elephants in India. And they herded up all the wild elephants. They took the baby elephants out of the herd, and they started their training by putting a rope around their right front leg and then wrapping the rope around a tree and snubbing them up to that tree. And the baby elephant pulled and tugged and pulled, but it eventually came to believe that when the rope is tight, it's futile to pull. And so when the rope got tight, the baby elephant just stood there, and then the trainer started more training. But always in his training, reinforced this belief that when the rope is tight, it's futile to pull. So they ended this movie with a huge elephant pulling trees with a harness on its around it, pulling trees out of the forest for harvest. And at the lunch break, in order to hold the big elephant where they wanted it, they drove a relatively short stake in the ground, deep enough that when they put a rope around the big elephant's right front leg and then wrapped the other end of the rope around that stake, the elephant could move around, but when he got to the end of the rope and the stake got tight, the rope got tight, it couldn't pull. The stake didn't hold the elephant. The rope didn't hold the elephant. The limiting belief that they imposed on it when it was a baby is what held the elephant. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous with approximately 943,002 baby elephant beliefs, just like that. Stuff that, you know, you don't even know you know this stuff. But you live it, and it has to be true. You base your sense of well-being on it being true. And the fact is, you don't even know you know it. It's just that it don't work and you don't feel good. I think the first thing that I was taught that may have been the most frustrating in my life was that I was separate from God. Now, in the church I went to, God was an anthropomorphic being up in heaven. And I was a little kid in Kansas. Now, even the dumb kids know that you're separate then. You know, if they'd have said God was in Kansas City, I would have known that we were separate. But I was also told, if you do what God wants you to do, and there were plenty of people to tell you what God wanted you to do, if you would do that, then in times of crisis, you can ask God in prayer to help you go through the problem. Or to take the problem away. That was what I always wanted. You know, and I remember the first time I prayed and remembered who I was praying to and what I was praying for. I was about 4 or 5 years old, and we were in this church, and we prayed fervently for God not to let it rain until the wheat had been harvested. It rained that day. It hailed that day. The wind blew and wiped out the whole wheat crop in Sumner County, Kansas. And while nobody pointed their finger at me, I knew whose fault it was. I knew who wasn't doing what you have to do for God to answer your prayer. And I figured you guys were doing it, you know. And I was the one that had... You know, and if you're 4 or 5 years old and you've assumed the entire responsibility for wiping out the Kansas wheat crop, what you have is an ego problem. You see, assuming responsibility to make things happen that you lack the power to make happen. But I'm telling you, as a baby elephant, that was how I was taught to live. And if I could just get you, now I knew what was right. I was right, I knew that. Man, you gotta be right if you're gonna feel good. You gotta be right. And if I could just get you to do the right thing, and I know the right thing, then you would be happy. I would be happy. We would all be happy. It's just that, in retrospect, it wasn't real clear to me what it was I really wanted you to do. So I couldn't really articulate it. I just knew that I'm not happy, so you've got to change. I've always known that. And it didn't work. Well, my dad, my whole family were Germans, and I don't mean happy-go-lucky Bavarian beer garden Germans. I mean Prussian. I mean Nazis. I mean disciplinarians. They'd whoop you. Dad would beat you. He beat me three times. Once is enough. Once you get really beaten, from then on, you're in a state of low-grade alert about what the hell's going on, you know. And there's no problems. There's no problems except you're in this state of impending calamity, impending doom, the big book calls it. And I lived that way. I'll tell you, getting beaten, I don't think makes you an alcoholic. But I never got where I like being beaten. I understand there are people. Mostly in California. But I'm not like that. You beat me and I'm going to feel bad. I don't ever think I felt good until I was 12, 13, something like that. And I drank about a half a pint of whiskey. And you guys know what, you know, it's just a good feeling. And my thought was, this is what they mean when they say, let's go have a few drinks and get the feeling good. Let's go have a few drinks and be somebody. Well, I was a jerk. I didn't want to be a jerk, but I'd rather be a jerk than be a nobody. And so that got into it. And when I was in the seventh grade, I met this red-headed girl who was probably the best behaved and most popular girl in town, and I fell in love with her. And because I've been in love with her now for the thousands of years that I've been in love with her, I know that I fell in love with her when we were in the seventh grade. And she was my girlfriend. I've loved her all my life, except for when I hated her. And we finally, I went to the Navy in the Korean War, and I heard her and her boyfriend broke up, and I came right home to tell her I loved her, and that I hoped that she would be, I wasn't proposing marriage or anything, I was just saying, I've always loved you, I love you now, and I wanted to tell you that. And I also, when I was in the Navy, I learned Shakespeare. Now, I memorized a ton of Shakespeare. So I said to her, now she's going to, if she was speaking at this thing, she would deny all this, but she isn't, and I am, and I'm right. Did not the heavenly rhetoric of thine eyes, against whom all the world cannot hold argument, persuade my heart to this? And she fell like a ton of bricks for me and for Shakespeare. And so we got married. September 22nd, 1953, and we were 20 years old, and I got out of the Navy in October, and we made a home in Wichita. I went to work at Boeing as a tool maker, and then within the 11 months later, just to get the statistics straight, we had a son. And then her dad... And her dad kind of became, maybe I'll be able to explain it later, but this little incident kind of became important to me early in my sobriety. First, let me tell you, the first drink I had, I knew how to feel good. and I knew how to be somebody. And then Butch talked to Pat and said, I don't think you ought to marry Howard. My mother talked to Pat and said, I don't think you ought to marry Howard. Everybody was telling her, but good untreated Al-Anon, she just hung right in there. Her dad and I, after Pat and I were married, her dad and I sat down in his office, which was the butcher shop, and he was a butcher, and he said, Howard, and he poured me about a 3-ounce drink. He said, I want you to know there's nothing wrong with drinking whiskey. It takes the edge off if you're stressed out. It'll give you a sense of well-being sometimes when nothing else will. There's nothing wrong with taking a drink for that. But there is something wrong with getting drunk. By this time in his talk, I was out of whiskey. And I'm not really this dumb, but looking back on it, it wasn't really a choice. I said, Butch, I like what you're saying. I'm very interested in it, but could you pour me another drink? That, it was just kind of a stake in the ground, you see, with the progressiveness of my drinking. Then Butch got killed, and Pat and I went to San Diego. And I went to work for Ryan Aeronautical as a toolmaker. And Pat, we had another son. And then I got laid off on Friday as a toolmaker, and Monday I got a job as an entry-level engineer. I didn't have an engineering degree yet, but I had been studying engineering, and I thought I got this job because I had conned him. I'd snowed him. And but it turned out I was a process analyst. We analyze processes. And I was good at this. But you have to write reports. And I couldn't write a report. I couldn't think of, you know, and as soon as I can't do something that I have to do, I get anxious. And then I just kind of seize up and am immobilized. And one Wednesday, I hadn't even started on this week's report, which has to be done Friday. I think that's a law of nature. All reports have to be done Friday. And I took the stuff home to work on it. And I don't drink much now, except on weekends. I'm kind of the captain of the patio parties. And I bring the beer to the patio parties. And this one guy that lived on our back fence, he didn't like my beer. It was called Edelweiss. You could get a case of it for $1.25 at Texas liquor store. Now, it admittedly had a sour taste, a distinctly sour taste for beer when you first started drinking it, but it would get you where you wanted to go. But not Bandy. Anyway, I came home that Wednesday and I sat down at the table and seized up. I couldn't, I just was immobilized. And I got up and went to the refrigerator with nothing specific in mind. Just see what was going on in the refrigerator. And and what was going on was about a half a pint of Jim Beam whiskey was sitting there. And I picked it up and poured myself about a 3-ounce drink. And I sat down at the table and I'm sipping. And this came to my mind. You could start this report with a brief explanation of what prompted you to do this analysis in the first place. Then you could succinctly describe each significant finding of the analysis. And once you've listed those, you could then make recommendations for either changing the design or the process based on the analysis results. Now I'm thinking, and I get up and go get the whiskey and sat down and I write a report. I discovered a technical vocabulary that I didn't know I had. I didn't know that I, you know, and it was a good report. And I wasn't drunk, but I was brilliant. And I took the report in, they typed it up, I signed it, my boss signed it. Now, my boss's boss, the next Tuesday, came walking out to my desk with my report. And he said, "Howard, did you write this report?" I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "This is a good report." And I said, "Thank you." And he said, "We knew you could do it if you just give us the effort." And I remember thinking, "Effort your ass." I gave you effort, and I couldn't write the report. It was whiskey. But I knew, don't tell him whiskey. Let him think effort. They won't give you any money for whiskey. They will for effort. And the important thing is, I know it's whiskey. And whiskey it was. And the way that works is, very quickly you discover you don't have to wait till Wednesday night to start this. You can start it on Monday night. Then you see you don't have to wait till the night at all. You can start it at lunch. And then ultimately, it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon someplace. When it's 6 o'clock in the morning in California. And so you're drinking all the time. And I was a process analyst. I was an engineer. I was a senior engineer. I moved to Hughes in 1966 and was a senior engineer. And I then got to be an engineering manager. Didn't set the world on fire, but it's a steady, progressive series of promotions that I got because I drank whiskey. Long about 1970, I have to drink so much whiskey before I get brilliant that my speech is slurred. And Pat thinks I'm drunk. My boss thinks I'm drunk. Now, there's a good word even today. It's called synchronicity or God working in your life, or whatever what you want to call it. But that was happening in the middle of my drinking because this guy came into the Tattletale Bar where I drank regularly, and he sold little white pills with crosses on them, which were wrapped up in a roll. They were in a roll, and they were wrapped up with tinfoil around them. You got these, and you thought, well, those look like lifesavers. They are. There was no problem in the world that a combination of booze and Denny's didn't solve for me, except for controlling my bowels. Booze and Denny's do not help in that particular area. I just had trouble once, really. Unfortunately, I was in bed with Pat at the time. I know it. She, talk about trauma. That was a traumatic experience for Pat. We got twin beds, and we still have twin beds. That happened early in 1972. A lot of things happened in 72. My boss took me out of management because he and none of the people that worked for me had any credibility in my management. Pat was always going to leave me, but this time I knew she meant it. She was going to leave me, and I talked her into staying. And I was going to quit drinking altogether. And now I can't. I just tell you, if I know I loved her with all my heart, but I didn't drink for about 2 weeks. And I said, Pat, we've got to talk. I want you to stay with me, and I want us to keep our family together, and we can make this work. But if I can't drink at all, I guess you'll have to go. I didn't want that choice, but I didn't have no choice, really. And I said, all I'm going to do is drink a half a pint a day. She stayed. She fell for that like she fell for everything. And I kept getting further and further in debt. Pat paid all the bills. She ran the budget, and she kept us within the budget if she knew. But I had a credit card called a Bank AmeriCard that I was using, and when I was out of the limit on it, I'd borrow money from the credit union. And I'd pay the credit card down so that they'd give me a new one. And then I would borrow money from a Bank America on the Bank America card. And then I'd go to another branch, and you could borrow less than $45. And they wouldn't check to see how much you owed them. And I'd get three or four Banks of America for $45, give myself a little early space, and then I'd go to the post office and buy a money order to send in a $75 payment on. I never missed a payment. It just kept going up, and then I'd borrow here, and a lot of stress. And I had an opportunity to sell some equipment that I didn't own. Equipment that I found right before the U.S. government lost it. And Hughes had the equipment, and I got it out of the guard gate. And I give it to a fence, and the fence and the equipment disappeared. And I'm sitting in the tattletale on, I think, July the 23rd. In 1972, and telling anybody want to buy test equipment. And when I awakened the next morning, I was on page 8 in the big book. Now, part of what she was saying earlier is when I make stuff up, what I do is make stuff up and say that it's in the big book. And then I make up page numbers. Nobody ever checks, and it adds to my credibility of my talk. On page 8, it says, there are no words to express the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand spread out in all directions. And that was my bottom. Quicksand. It wasn't when I got fired. That was pretty solid, so I think I can drink now. Not when I could get Pat to stay home. You know, that's pretty solid. I'll just drink a half a pint a day. Each time, except this time, there was no bottom. The equipment was gone. It was owned by the federal government. Its value exceeded the amount that would ultimately require an investigation by the Federal Bureau of Investigators. And although some of them were drunk, as were some of the cops and the judges, I didn't know that, and I knew I had to stop drinking. I have to stop drinking. I don't steal stuff. I'm not a thief. I don't do this stuff if I'm not drunk. And I'm going to go to AA. Pat, this last time when she was going to leave me, she went went to a lawyer, and he said, well, have him go to AA. Sound like an alcoholic. And she said to me, the lawyer said you should go to AA. And I said, Pat, listen to lawyers. AA is for people whose lives are in trouble because of their drinking. That don't fit us. Oh, she said. And then I thought, if I go to AA, Pat will like that. And I can hide out there until this equipment thing blows over. Then I can go back drinking. And I called this guy that I believe was the president of Alcoholics Anonymous Worldwide. All my stories are too long. That's why I get this far along, and I'm not very far along. But I called him and asked him if he'd take me to an AA meeting sometime. He said, how about tonight? No, I can't do it tonight. I've got stuff to do tonight, but sometime later. You know, he talked me into tonight. And then he said, are you drinking now? And I said, no, I had just finished a half a pint. But I'm not drinking now. I'm going to drink as soon as I hang up, but right now I'm not drinking. See, rigorously honest, out to shoot. And he said, well, try not to drink anymore. Because if you're too drunk, you can't help the meeting, and the meeting won't help you. And I drank three more half a pints of whiskey. I took a lethal dose of Benzedrine. And by 6 o'clock, I did not know why I had called AA at all. Things are just not that bad. I hope this guy don't come. But he came. And I got into the truck, and I said, I am not an alcoholic. And he said, I don't know if you're an alcoholic or not, but I know we're going to the right place. I said, don't tell anybody that I'm going to AA. And he said, Howard, when I came to AA, I had that same thought. And the guy that brought me said, everybody in your life that knows you at all, that you care about or care about you, knows that your life is messed up because of your drinking. And AA is going to do everything it can to keep it from those people that you might want to get your act together. We're going to let them think that you want to stay screwed up. And I said, don't tell them anyway. I got the story, but don't tell them. Took me to the Culver City Studio Group, which is the oldest meeting in the west side of Los Angeles. And he introduced me to this guy that sat there. And he looked very unhappy. And he said, Frank, turns out it was Kenny's sponsor. He said, Frank, I want you to meet Howard. This is Howard's first AA meeting. And Frank looked up and smiled. That was his smile. He said, Howard, welcome to AA. I hope that you will join us in doing the things that we do. And if you will, after a time, you will discover a life magnitudes better than you ever dreamed your life could be. Now, I don't know about you guys. Well, I know some of you. Some of you were deep thinkers. But in the Tattletale, we were deep thinkers. Nothing is as easy as it looks. If something can go wrong, it will go wrong, and at the worst possible time. Put that on a sign and put that sign on the bulletin board. That's a fundamental truth. of life, and none of us should ever forget that. Life sucks. And then you die. Put that on the bulletin board. Don't trust anybody. You know your buddy so brave and true. Well, you get to him before he gets to you. These were all important things that I knew. Baby elephant beliefs from the tattletale. And Frank told me that, and I believed him, and I trusted him. Now, later I might say to somebody, I might have said, how come do you think I trusted Frank when I didn't trust anybody and I tried not to trust anybody? If you'd been around a while, you might have said, well, Howard, that's God's grace. That's God's goodness to give you enough sense of well-being that you would encourage to stay. And then I went to ask somebody that would talk sense to me. I didn't want to hear about God. And at that meeting, it was a beginner's meeting, and is anybody here in the first meeting? And I was the only one. Whenever someone was there for the first meeting, they had a pat and mic routine that they did with some of these old timers there that sounded like it was improvisation or impromptu, but it was finely tuned and finely honed. And so they called on Chuck Innes, and Chuck said, after work at MGM, he was a film editor at MGM, he said, I'd go across the street to the backstage bar just to have one drink, maybe two, three at the most. And the next thing you knew, it was last call for alcohol. And he was arguing with the bartender, your clock is fast, you got time for me to have one more double, and by God, I want it. And I thought, hell, I've done that lots of times. And then he said, Tuesday, I would just stop by for a drink, and Wednesday. But he said, I always closed the place up. And he said, my life just went down the tubes, and I came day again. And they told me that those things is what characterizes the alcoholic. That we are obsessed each time we start to drink with the insane idea that somehow, some way, this time I'm just going to have one or two, three at the most. And coupled with that insane obsession is a physical reaction that manifests itself in a phenomenon of craving for more once we start. So we stay because we have this craving that we cannot will ourselves not to give in to. I thought, well, you know, and then they call on Bob Suttles, and he tells his story much the same, and they call on somebody else, and at the break, I tell Kenny, well, I identify with that. That's the way I drink, and I have those, that's what happens. But if you have to have a craving for alcohol, to be an alcoholic, I'm not an alcoholic because I never craved to drink. He said, well, what time did you start drinking? I said, 6 a.m. He said, why? I said, because I had a hangover, and it was the only way I could get rid of a hangover. He said, okay, once you got rid of the hangover, did you keep drinking? And, you know, I saw it coming, but what can you do by then? I said, well, I had another one, but only because I wanted it. I didn't crave it. And he said, you know, there's a class of alcoholic. Many of them are very productive, sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous, who, once they started to drink, kept slugging them down so fast that the craving didn't have an opportunity to show itself. And I thought, that's the kind of alcoholic I am. And Second half of the meeting, they talked about fake it till you make it. They talked about the doorknob. And I agreed with your first reaction to the doorknob. That's stupid. But I didn't say that. And then a guy got up and he said, my name is John. I'm an alcoholic. Everybody said, hi, John. He said, they also call me John the Baptist because Jesus Christ is my higher power. He's my Lord and Savior. When I get up in the morning, I ask Jesus to help me stay sober. I try to think of Jesus all day long, and at the end of the day, I thank him. And I thank Alcoholics Anonymous for bringing my Savior back into my life. And my head said, yes, yeah, I understand all of that. If I could con myself into that fantasy, I have tried that many times. I would have that, but I can't kid myself that way. I got to live in the real world, which that day was 4 half pints of whiskey and a lethal dose of Benzedrine. How is that for the real world? And at the end of the meeting, we're going out, and Leo has John the Baptist in the corner. And he's telling him, I've told you don't bring Jesus into the AA meeting. You're going to scare away the newcomers. It occurred to me, and I didn't do it. I wished I had it. And that was go back and say, hey, Leo, if you're not going to scare the newcomers away with the doorknob, I wouldn't worry about Jesus. Anyway, I told Kenny I wasn't going to do the steps, and he said, you don't need to. He said, I understand, but stop drinking and stop taking Bendix. I didn't tell him I was taking Bendix. I don't know how he knew. Unless he noticed I said things real fast over and over again. I went, Kenny said, I need you to stop drinking and stop using and go to a lot of meetings. And don't worry about the steps, but listen to people there on what they're sharing that makes their life better. And if it sounds like it would work for you, you take that and make it part of your program. But in the meantime, don't drink and don't take bennies. I got drunk one more time. It was a week. It was Monday through Friday, but it was a humdinger. So my AA birthday is August the 4th, 1972. And I went to meetings and I listened. Now my head talks to me all, it's like when they read in chapter 5, remember we deal with alcohol cunning, baffling. My head would say, alcohol isn't cunning. You have to have an intellect to be cunning. Alcohol doesn't have an intellect. They got that wrong. There is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find, aha, they just got through saying alcohol is powerful. Now they say God has all power. You can't have that both ways. If alcohol has power, God is not all powerful. He just has all power except that power alcohol has. Now, the fatal flaw in that is that when I'm thinking that way, I'm missing stuff that could have saved my life. So you want to try to not think those things. But it wasn't easy for me. But I heard Tommy O'Mara in Beverly Hills, California. Tommy O'Mara said, if you make one mistake and brood about that, and brood about making that mistake, you've made two mistakes. Man, I took that home. That was, now, then I heard Ski from San Diego say, I was 36 years in learning that all the people that I hated didn't feel it. And it was killing me. Gee, I'm going to take that home. Now, I took those things home. And I had hope. One of the other speakers talked about the hope we get. I hoped I had learned something. And some of us believe all our lives, if we learn something intellectually, we have changed. Wrong. But I would learn these things, but I couldn't apply them, but I kept going. I didn't drink, and I kept going. And there's an actor by the name of Archie Johnson. He passed away probably 10 years ago now, but I heard Archie talking in the Pacific Palisades, and he said, I was so busy this week wanting what I was getting that I didn't have time to worry about getting what I wanted. And I thought, well, let's stick him in the eye with a sharp stick. Let's check that out. Let's see him love that. Because that's the way I think. But I went outside, and it was raining as hard as it can rain in the Pacific Palisades. And I've hated the rain since I wiped out the wheat crop. And so I'm hating the rain. I run to the car. I get in. I'm soaked to the skin. And this voice that's talking better to me than it used to said, that's what Archie was talking about. That's what Mark Twain was talking about. That's what Will Rogers was talking about. Love the rain, because it's going to rain anyway. And the worst problem you can have is not loving what's going to happen anyway. I went home, took a shower, dried off, got into bed. We had wooden shingles, and you could hear the rain on them. It was soothing, and I loved it, and I went to sleep. And when I woke up, it stopped raining. My first reaction is, no, it should be. And then I knew. Love it not raining, you know? And I made the adjustment. Now, you may say, how did that happen? If I had asked, to start with, you'd have said, that's God's grace. God just gave you that so that you'd have hope. And then I'd have talked to somebody else, because I was not into God. I used to quit AA 2 or 3 times a week, sometimes more. This one Saturday, I'm mowing the lawn, and we got a beat-up old lawnmower, and I hit a tree with it, and then I hit the bolt that's holding the handle on the lawnmower with my chest bone right here. And it hurts bad. And I think, damn Pat, anyway. I wouldn't be mowing the lawn if it wasn't for Pat. I know that. She's not around. But it's her fault, because it's always her fault. And damn AA, too. AA don't work. If AA worked, would my chest hurt? I don't think so. I'm not going to those meetings and grin like a baboon and say, isn't this wonderful? It isn't wonderful. It isn't ever going to be wonderful. I'm not going to drink, but I'm not going to AA anymore. That night, I forgot that I wasn't going. And Clarence came and got, because I always forgot. I always went, but I'd go through this litany of why I wasn't. And he took me to the Malibu meeting, and a guy named Don Gates was speaking. And he said, if you're new in AA and you're not working the steps, AA will stop being fun, and you'll decide AA doesn't work. And then you'll decide to stop going to meetings. You don't go to meetings for a while, then you'll go back to the bar and order a drink. And if you do that, and the bartender says, what's the matter? I thought you was going to AA. Don't AA work? If you're not working the steps, he said, be honest with the bartender and tell him you don't know if AA would work or not, because you weren't trying. And I knew my head didn't pop off at that. I knew that was the truth. And on the way home, I made a decision that I was going to work the step, that I could not believe that the program won't work for me if I won't work the steps. Now, in retrospect, I did a good job on the first half of the first step. Skipped the second half. Kind of skipped the second step. Because it was the same guy that I always believed in when I was drunk. Nothing changed. And my attitude about the third step was, well, if God's got me, he's had me all along, I ain't standing in his way. Do something good for me. Now, these are called half measures. And I know the book says half measures will avail you nothing. But I'm telling you, I did a good fourth step. And it changed my life. I had my dad in my head 90% of the time, blaming him for whatever problem I was experiencing. I did this inventory, and I saw my dad isn't my problem. That my wife isn't my problem. My job is, I saw that. I am the problem, and my big problem is I'm afraid. And I've always been afraid, and I saw that. Now, I still was afraid. But this was a significant change in my life. When I was in the sixth grade, I had an experience that I was ashamed of. I was actually a victim of somebody else, an older person, misconduct. But I was ashamed of it and full of remorse. And anytime anything made me think of it, that would go back through my mind. And when I started to do the fifth step, I said, how do you want to start? And he said, well, why don't you start by telling me the things that you had decided you weren't going to tell me at all. Well, I told him this thing and the other things. And then I read the rest of the stuff to him. And I felt good after the thing was over. The feeling that came to me was, I'm not going to drink. Man, I was 100 miles from a drink. But a feeling that became more and more obvious to me was the guilt and the remorse and the shame for that left me. And it went back to the sixth grade kid who was actually a victim. Now that's a big thing. That's a tall pole in the tent in anybody's life. That if you can get rid of something like that, then don't miss the opportunity to do it. I kind of skipped the sixth and the seventh step, but I did the eighth, the ninth step, and my sponsor tracked down the equipment that I'd stolen and sold. And I said, well, I'm not going to take that back. And he said, you don't have to. I just wanted to give you the opportunity to take it back. And so I went home and told Pat I'd stolen this equipment and she went to the bank and signed a note with me, and I got the money, and she sat in the car, and I went into the machine shop and bought the equipment. Paid the guy. I was not the best thief in the world. I mean, I didn't get any money for this when I sold it, and now I had to buy it back. Took Pat home, and she'd been going to Al-Anon now, and she said, is this it? You know, I said, Pat, I'm sorry about this. And she said, well, is this the last of this? And I said, yeah, there's more, but nothing like this. And she said, okay then. It's okay. Go on to work and see what Tom has to say. Well, Tom said, don't tell me about it. He was my boss. Don't tell me about it. Take the equipment out to the calibration lab. And I took it, and the next morning when I come in, there's a note on my desk. Howard, come and see me when you get in. I'd come in early, and Tom was earlier. Come and see me when you get in, Tom. And it's about 50 yards to his office, and it felt like 50 miles. And I got there, and he had coffee ready and poured me a cup of coffee and poured himself one and said, I just want to talk to you about that equipment that we were talking about last night. I had it calibrated. It's in perfect working order. And I don't know where it's been, but I know it wasn't stolen. Because I have it. And if it was really stolen, I wouldn't have it. Isn't that right? And I said, oh, yes. He said, okay, but you mustn't tell anybody. Because I've read the procedures carefully, and there are no provisions for bringing it back. If we know you stole it, we have to fire you. So don't tell anybody. Don't get me in that kind of trouble. And I haven't told anybody. In 37 years, I've kept that a secret. And I mention it tonight in case there's any new people. So I can tell you that the next morning when I woke up, the truth is The weight of the world was lifted off my shoulders, and I felt as good or better than I had felt when I took my first drink. This was just a great, good feeling. And I have had those great, good feelings as I've continued on in the program. I've gotten promoted, and I always, my belief was, I'm making this happen. I'm making it happen. And finally, I reached my career goal. I was the manager of a technical section in the systems engineering department on the Apache helicopter design. And that was a great job. It was my career goal. And now I'll be happy. And I was for about 3 days. And my boss came in and gave me assignment where it was way above my, I just way out of my reach. And he said, well, that's what a section manager's job is. That's within the work assignment of a section manager. Well, that was dreadful, I'm telling you. Now, I started meditating when I was a couple years sober. On October the 1st, 1974, I made a commitment. I'm going to meditate for 30 minutes a day, every day, for the rest of my life. And for over 30 years, I never missed a day. And so I'm meditating during these periods. And God gives us brains to use. And I don't think God has talked to me. Clancy said one time when he heard me talk, and he just wanted to make something clear to me. He said, prayer is when you talk to God. When God talks to you, that is schizophrenia. I'm not worried about, I do think that's a funny line, but God gives us brains to use. And if we can settle our thoughts down and give our brains a chance, they give you new thoughts that actually apply in a meaningful way to your life if you work in the steps. That just happened to turn out good for me. And at the end of this meditation, I had a good feeling. And I knew if I stopped the meditation and backed out, I was backing back out into the dreadfulness. And so my mind said, why can't I feel good without having to meditate? And then I saw a vision in my mind's eye of a frozen lake. And it's my fantasy, so I know that the ice is as thick as the laws of physics will allow ice to get. And I'm thinking, what the hell is this about? I knew you could put a Sherman tank on the ice and that the ice would support it. And then the thought came to me. Walking across the frozen lake a step at a time would be a good metaphor for living your life a day at a time. Be careful because it's slippery. And by the way, if you're not absolutely convinced that the ice is thick enough to support you, you're going to dread every step you take. Now I could back out. And nothing was very clear to me about this. But gradually, I had a clarity about going back and going through the steps again and coming to believe. And then when you read the book, when I read the book with this new idea in mind, I found things like, we have a few general principles that don't conflict with anybody's religious denomination. Well, I was conflicting with religious denominations. That's what I was doing for 9 years. And so I went back into the chapter, We Agnostics, and I looked for these general principles. And in general, there you got to be open to the possible existence of a spirit of the universe underlying the totality of things, which is all-powerful, guiding, creative intelligence, manifesting precise law, in everything. Just a few general principles. Which you can validate through science, the book says, and you can. Or through the history of your own life. You can find that while we were afraid, fear was a corrosive thread through the fabric of our life. But when we look at our lives and see that the things we were afraid of never happened, or if they did happen, they turn out to be the best things that could have happened, then you see a golden thread being pulled through your life in a spiritual way that you can trust. You can have a sense of well-being based on that truth and the validation of that pervasive presence and power through your own life and through your own universe. And we have plugged away on that, and I have a wonderful life, Pat and I. Anyway, I'm running out of time. I see that Terry's getting up to leave, so. I was reading this book on meditation. It says, whatever way you find God, that is the right way for you. If you think God out intellectually and validate his presence, that's the right way for you. Or if you just sense his presence, you just feel his pervasive presence and power, that's the right way for you. But wherever you see God pass, mark that spot and go sit in that window again. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous, these meetings, you people, that is my window. Thank you so much, and I love you. Thank you for letting me share.